From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Ricky Bevington, in for Celeste Headlee. Atlanta was recently named one of the best places in the country to be single.
It's not a city for, like, lovebirds. It's a city for people who are probably trying to build something as far as career-wise, or people who are here to party or have fun.
That was LaTanya of Atlanta. We will discuss the ups and downs of the city's dating scene ahead in this hour. But first, yesterday we talked about the GOP's tax plan, how it could make it easier for churches to influence politics.
The IRS shouldn't be able to control what pastors, priests, imams, and rabbis say to their congregations during their religious worship services as a part of their religious teaching, period.
Daniel Blomberg is legal counsel for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. Here are your first thoughts. This is David Scher from Marietta.
What I'd like to know is why are churches and places of worship tax exempt in the first place? If they believe God will carry them through, then why are they entangling themselves with government and finance? Why should the rest of us who don't participate be effectively taxed and supporting them?
We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook. And we might feature your comments on the show. FBI data released last month show an uptick in reported hate crimes. Nationwide, 2016 saw more than 6,100 incidents. That is up by more than 270 from the year before. Georgia reported a drop in hate crimes during that period. But a recent ProPublica investigation finds many police departments, including Georgia's, aren't trained to identify and investigate hate crimes, so some may go unreported. ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson joins me from New York. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on.
What I always like to do when talking about a big issue is defining the terms that we're going to be using for the next 10 or so minutes. So for our audience, can you break down for us what is a hate crime?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is that Georgia doesn't have a hate crimes law. Most states do, but the federal definition applies in Georgia. And that says basically you cannot commit a crime that is motivated by your bias or hatred towards the victim's identity in terms of race, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientation, etc.
And there's two aspects to a hate crime. There's not only proving that the hate crime, that the crime itself existed, there's the intent. Talk about how complicated this is for law enforcement officers and prosecutors to prove intent.
Exactly. That's the thing that confuses a lot of people is, you know, saying something mean and racist towards somebody is generally protected by the First Amendment and generally not a crime. Saying something mean and racist to someone while you are assaulting them, that is typically a hate crime. So the hate crime is sort of looking at the motivation that attaches to an underlying crime, vandalism, assault, intimidation. That's the hate crime part. And that's the hard thing to figure out for police detectives. This is one of the only areas of criminal law where investigators really have to get inside the motivation, inside the mindset of the criminal and be able to prove that beyond a doubt in the courtroom. Most of the time, all you need is evidence. This person attacked that person. We've got the evidence. That's exactly what happened. You don't have to say why the person attacked the other person.
You spoke to Brian Levin, who oversees the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. In 2015, he gave an interview with the Tavis Smiley Show. Levin said, "We are all subject to bigotry."
Prejudice as an attitude consists of three things: emotion, belief system, and how we manifest it, how we act out on it. And we all have to examine, wait a minute, you know, what are my feelings driving here, and what are the belief systems I'm relying on?
Is he suggesting that people may, you know, commit a crime and may not even understand their own intentions as it being a hate crime?
Yeah, and I think he's looking also at sort of the submerged internal racism and various other isms that may propel us. But definitely there are moments when people lash out. They engage in what will later be determined to be a hate crime, and they're not even necessarily aware that that is what they're doing.
So why is it so important that police officers get this kind of training? And what did you find when you called police departments all around the country in terms of how they're training officers?
There's sort of two parts, right? And the first part is that we know that the federal statistics are terrible. They are abysmal. They do not capture the true scope of the problem. At least 12% of the departments around the country do not participate in the hate crimes tracking program. And many, 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 many more submit faulty data. They submit incomplete, incorrect data to the federal government. So the first part is that we don't know the full extent of the problem, and that's insane. We should be able to capture that information in this modern technological information age and have a true sense of the problem. The second piece is this. There are a lot of states, and Georgia is one, that do not train officers on any kind of regular basis as they're coming onto the force and how to investigate these difficult, complex, and terrifying crimes. So when we were reaching out to the police training councils around the country, we found that a lot of states have no mandate to either a legal mandate or a policy mandate that says, hey, every recruit coming into police academy before they join the force needs to know about hate crimes, they need to know the law, they need to know how to respond, and they need to know how to make the community feel as at ease as possible in a difficult situation.
Ellen Vest is a detective with the San Diego Sheriff's Department. She trains fellow officers to identify, investigate, and report hate crimes. Here she is in a documentary produced by the California-based group Not in Our Town. In this clip, we also hear her leading a class.
I think the most satisfying thing in my job is getting people to recognize, getting patrol to recognize gangs and to recognize what they're out there doing.
The white signifies that he's a racist skinhead, but he hasn't brought blood. With the reds, red shoelaces signifies he's brought blood. If you see two of these guys walking down the street, be afraid of the white laces. He's the one that's going to do the beating to earn his red laces.
AC Thompson, what is an example of how hate crime training should be done so officers know what they're looking for?
Well, the first thing is three different states that we talked to only spend about 30 minutes or less on the subject. So the first thing that you want to do is spend more time than that. And typically 2 to 4 hours is what experts have said is a good duration of time to spend on it. So the first thing is time. The next thing that you want to do is the sort of thing that the detective was talking about in that clip is sort of looking for the subtle clues that this may be a hate crime and that the person, the perpetrator may be a hate group member or, an unaffiliated hater. So, another example would be the Norse runes are often used by hate groups as a symbol of their affiliation with those hate groups. That's a thing that the typical officer may not notice because it's not a swastika. These are the kind of things you want to train about. You want to train about asking the victims questions that will help get to the motivation of why this might have happened, what words were said preceding this, and to recognize if the assailant is using particular phrases, that those may be indicators of a hate crime. Beyond that, it's just simply taking the victim seriously. We've interviewed police trainers who said, we don't really pay attention to what the victims say. It's not that important. How would they possibly know why their assailant attacked them? And that's just wrong. The truth of the matter is that overwhelmingly, the victims are the number one source of information in a hate assault or an act of intimidation.
AC Thompson, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's ProPublica reporter AC Thompson. You can find a link to this story at gpbnews.org. We asked for comment from police departments in Savannah, Athens, and Atlanta, but none provided a comment. HIV can now be diagnosed sooner and treated more effectively than it was for Christopher Harris. When he was diagnosed with the disease in 1988 at Grady Hospital, there was only one drug approved for treatment. Christopher became an early member of the Atlanta Buyers Club, which distributed unapproved drugs to treat AIDS patients. He recorded his story for NPR series StoryCorps.
I loved my wife as much as a gay man can love a woman. We lived together as a married couple for 14 years and had one child. And then I was at a bar one night and met this guy. And he was so handsome and so nice. It was the first time that I had fallen in love. And we were together until the day he died. We had not been together very long, and I was feeling ill. Well, I went to several private doctors, and they kept saying, nothing's wrong with you. You're just nervous because of your difficult divorce, you know. And I went to Grady, and during that time, the doctor asked me if I was in a high risk for this new disease that was going about. I said yes. So when I finally went back for my next appointment, the young resident, he was such a nice young man, he told me that I had AIDS. And I never shall forget, he was about to cry. And I said to the doctor, I had a child to raise, and I just could not die right then. He said, well, 12 to 14 months. But we're going to fight to make that better. Are you willing to fight? So we settled into the rigors of treatment. And then I was called in one day and told my T cells had dropped below 100. And he told me that there were some new drugs out there. They might help you, but they weren't available. And so I said, well, what do I do? He said, well, there is a place here in town that you can get these drugs. And I said, where can I get them? He said, I can't tell you. And then he said, you dropped a piece of paper on the floor. I said, no, I didn't. He said, yeah, you did. And I looked down, there was a piece of paper he'd thrown across the desk. And I picked it up, and it was a phone number. And I called that number. And there were some guys who had just begun trying to distribute these medications that they were getting on the black market. I told them what I needed. They said, bring $50 in cash. So I went. I said, guys, thank you so much. This means so much. I said, I really wish I could help you. And they said, do you really mean that? I said, yeah. They said, well, be here Friday night. And I started working with them at the Buyers Club. And we were tough. We were just tough. But I think I'm the only one left. And they were wonderful guys.
That was Christopher Harris remembering the Atlanta Buyers Club. His story was produced for the NPR series StoryCorps. Just ahead, the secret to success for one of Cartoon Network's most popular shows, Rick and Morty. But first, what's it like to be single in Atlanta? This is On Second Thought. When a man loves a woman, can't keep his mind on nothing else. He takes the world for the good things. She is bad, he can't see it. She can do no wrong. Turn his back on his best friend, he puts her down. It's On Second Thought. I'm Ricky Bevington, in for Celeste Headlee. Finding romance in a big city can take a lot of time and work.
We're going to get you back on the dating scene, bro. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's actually why we're here. We want to put your profile on Match.com.
First thing we got to do is we got to take your picture for the profile. So.
Yeah. So do you have the makeup?
Yeah.
Oh, no makeup!
Come well, on. Those Hornets things are pretty bad, buddy,
yeah,
so I think we're going to have
I am who I am.
If you are looking in Atlanta, your chances are better than a lot of places. Wallet Hub just finished a survey that says Atlanta's one of the best cities to be single. And here to talk more about Atlanta's dating scene are three experts. Brittany Manson, who writes the Alone in Atlanta blog. Welcome back, Brittany.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Also with us is Atlanta-based artist Matthew Terrell. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Ricky.
And we're joined by Victoria Elizabeth, who's creator and co-host of the You Don't Know Me podcast. She features a series on her podcast called The Tinder Files. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Brittany, the last time you were on our show 2 years ago, we had you discuss the large number of single women compared to single men in Atlanta. Ratios matter. The Martin Prosperity Institute analyzed census data and found there are roughly 80,000 more single women than single men in the city. First of all, I just want to say I love that somebody spends money studying who's single in America.
Right.
Just going to get that out of the way.
Why didn't I get that
good
job?
For you.
Seriously.
So in your opinion, Brittany, has it become easier to date as a single woman?
I think it's easier if you open yourself to different opportunities to date. You know, if you're not open to online dating, speed dating, meeting somebody in the grocery store in the fruit section, like, it could definitely be hard because unless, you know, he's delivering Domino's pizza or something, he's not going to show up at your doorstep. So as long as you're open to different aspects of dating, I think it can be good. Like, your chances can be great.
So you pretty much have to wear makeup everywhere you go. Is that what you're telling the single ladies?
I mean, I'm not saying you have to go full face like when you're going to the gas station to pump gas. But, I mean, it wouldn't hurt if you know, just kind of spruced yourself up. Don't go out in your, like, bathrobe and fuzzy slippers or anything like that. You know, just make yourself presentable.
Victoria, you've lived in a number of cities in the U.S. and abroad. How does Atlanta stack up as a city for dating?
I think it really depends on how you're defining dating, too. In terms of affordability to actually go out and, like, do things and, like, be social, that I actually think Atlanta's a great city. I've lived in, you know, some cities in Europe that are really expensive, like Stockholm, which is actually the only other place I tried online dating, Tinder, to be specific. And it's kind of hard to enjoy the city as much. So I think Atlanta, in terms of affordability, in terms of accessibility, is actually really, really good.
So speaking of meeting people, we spoke with some people in Atlanta about the dating scene, and our producer, Emily Curitan, actually talked to them in the most unique place. They were washing their hands in a co-ed bathroom at a bar. I can't think of a better environment in which to meet somebody, right? I've never heard of a co-ed, you know, washroom in a bathroom bar, but here are their voices.
All the businesses along the Beltline and the way the city has grown, I personally think it's a really good city that you can find a relationship in, of course.
It's not a city for, like, lovebirds. It's a city for people who are probably trying to build something as far as career-wise, or people who are here to party or have fun.
Atlanta's a good city to be single in, but to find a relationship, I think it might be hard. Because Atlanta has such good nightlife and no one's ready to commit, honestly.
Seems like there's like exceptionally great women, and the men are just really like below average, like across the board, relatively consistently, unfortunately.
Those were the voices of Greg of Atlanta, Latonia of Atlanta, and Chris of Smyrna, and Gauthamy of Atlanta. So speaking of the men, Matthew, we'll have you represent. You are openly gay. How is Atlanta as a city for dating within the LGBT community?
You know, Atlanta is such a gay-friendly city. I travel all over. And I will say, sometimes I feel like it's a gayer city, more friendly and open city than even San Francisco. But perhaps it's like a critical mass of too many gay people because there's this feeling of, well, there's always somebody else around the corner, so why settle down right now with this person?
But according to what Brittany was saying, that might not be a gender thing. It may just be that there's so many options, and nobody of any gender, of any preference, really wants to settle down because you can always swipe right one more time for possibly a better option. I've heard this from friends. Do you guys see this in your expert opinions?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think you could probably launch a study on how online dating and how Tinder and how all these apps have really impacted the dating scene across the country and, like, our culture around dating, right? So I do hear a lot of people talk about, especially when I interview them, I hear I'm burned out on dating. I'm burned out on Tinder. I hear that a lot. Which was something that used to be relegated to, like, jobs or, you know, maybe to doing something that you don't love doing, right? And it's kind of this weird culture of, like, dating becoming another job.
Mm-hmm. You actually spoke with somebody on your podcast, The Tinder Files. Here's someone who you talked to who goes by Z. He lives in Atlanta, and he admits he does get burned out by dating.
You know, as a guy, like, you know, modern, like, equality aside, like, regardless of all of that, it's still a dude's role most of the time, not always, most of the time, to move things forward. And if a dude doesn't move things forward, well, it's not going to go anywhere. And sometimes I just, I don't know about other guys, but I just burn out on it after a while. I don't want to move anything forward.
Brittany, I'll ask you to speak to this, the gender dynamics of and the expectations across gender in dating in Atlanta.
Well, when I first heard the study from Wallet Hub about, you know, this being the second best city for dating and singles, at first I was like, I don't think they have the right city, because there's no way that this could be the second best city for singles and dating. But then I had to step back and think about it. I'm like, I'm reading more into this study than what it is. Like, the study said it's the best city for singles and dating, not necessarily monogamy, commitment, and relationships. So if you want to date here, or you're going to find dates here. But I think sometimes we go into the situation expecting more than what we really should just be expecting, which is just the date at that moment, especially with women. I think a lot of times we go into a situation already pairing their last name with our first. We're already picking out China patterns, you know, who's going to be my bridesmaid. And it's just the first date. So I think the main thing that makes dating hard here in Atlanta sometimes is the expectations, and people are not making their expectations known immediately. You know, a guy could just be going into it for the date. Like, I just want someone to talk to for the moment. She's going into it looking for a husband within the next 3 to 6 months. So as long as everybody makes their expectations known, like, then it could be okay.
Yeah, all cards on the table. Don't be judgy. It's just we're all here for our own reasons. I'm speaking with podcaster Victoria Elizabeth, blogger Brittany Manson, and Atlanta-based artist Matthew Terrell. Matthew, how has online dating changed the dating scene in the gay community in Atlanta?
Well, it's made it sort of a game. You know, the playing...
dating has always been a game.
Well, it's literally a game now, because you win, you lose. It's like, oh, how many people did I match with today?
Oh.
And it's really geared towards perpetually playing that game and never ending. And, you know, I, speaking as a man here, I want to say that men are terrible pigs. And... you do not need a man to define you or to complete you. I certainly do not. And I like to say I am an artist and I am in a relationship with my creative practice.
Mm. Wow. I'm going to use that next time somebody says, what's a nice girl like you doing not married? How about this? I would love for all of you to tell me very briefly a horror story. Victoria, you want to start?
I got to dig into the depths here.
And maybe what we learned. Obviously, you know, we could have plenty of conversations about safety with dating and just being smart when you're meeting strangers. But I also think that we need to inject some levity into the press. Oh, Matthew is raising his hand.
Okay.
I hope this is a funny horror story.
Okay, I had paid good money for tickets to go see a drag show with a guy. And he picked me up and he said... oh, well, we have to pick somebody else up on our way over.
What?
And me and this guy, we'd been on a couple dates before, and we'd spent the night together. And he's like, yeah, I have a boyfriend now, and I also got him tickets to the show, and we have to pick him up. And you have to get in the back seat of the car, too. And it was a two-door car, and it was just very small. I was crammed in the back seat and he picked up this guy who I knew, actually. And it was just incredibly, incredibly awkward. Zoom forward... year later, last night, they have broken up, and now he wants to go on a date again.
It's almost like there's no rules anymore.
It's the Wild West.
It's the Wild West. Brittany, what is your response to something that outlandish?
I mean, you just have to roll with the punches, unfortunately. You know, we're all in here because we have had our experiences with dating, good and bad, and you just can't let those deter you, unfortunately. Like, I mean, I've been writing alone in Atlanta for at least 5 years now, and it's not because people enjoy hearing my happy moments about dating. They enjoy hearing the horror stories about dating, but if you let it deter you, then you'll never get closer to finding who you're ultimately supposed to be with. So just roll with it. Laugh it off and keep it moving.
Well, I did lead this segment saying it's a lot of work. So let's hear from Gia Gales of Decatur. She's single, 37 years old, and she uses Tinder, admitting that the app can make it difficult to find meaningful relationships.
Honestly, a lot of people aren't that eloquent. I know that probably is not the greatest thing to say, but you know, sometimes people aren't that great at writing. So they're not interested in maybe telling their whole life story via Tinder. And that's fine, but then everybody's so on the go, they also don't take the time to really meet you and spend that in-person time that lets you know if there's going to be a connection or not.
Victoria, do you think people are lazy about dating?
Absolutely. I think we have a convenience culture around it too right now, just because it's a game. Like, it's, you know, you want to get straight to the point as quickly as possible. I think from, and it's different too for men and women, like right there. I think for a lot of men, I would go with that. I mean, a lot of men that I've encountered on Tinder don't really want to sit and talk on Tinder, whereas women are much more conversational and they want to like understand you, or at least this is from the interviews that I've done, the kind of the experiences that I've pulled from it. Obviously there are exceptions, but I would absolutely say that people are lazy, and the longer you do it, the lazier you get, the more efficient you want to be with it. You're like, all right, let's go.
So are all of you on online dating apps?
Yes.
What are your favorites? We're just going to go around the room. Oh, somebody's blushing already.
I actually pay for a subscription to Grindr and Scruff.
Okay. I know Grindr, but what's Scruff?
A little bit older, barrier, hairier. Man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Barrier, hairier. Barrier, love hairier. That.
To each his own.
Yes.
I have been on Match.com, POF, OkCupid, but currently I'm just on Tinder, and it's just about what we said. People are lazy. It's such an easy app. I could just swipe. If I don't like you, go to the left. Swipe. Mm. If I like you, go to the right. It's so convenient. So that's what I like about Tinder. But honestly, you get what you pay for. And I'm, you know, on the free version. So sometimes I don't come across, you know, the people of the utmost quality, but they are in quantity. So,
okay.
So I'm currently not on any of them because I met my significant other on Tinder.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah. accidentally, actually. But I was on, I even tried Happn, which was like a new one where you kind of cross paths with the person, and it's weirdly stalkerish. Like,
because your phone like geolocates
your phone geolocates you. So whoever you frequently cross paths with, in theory, is going to show up. So I only dated one person off of that, and it was a terrible experience. So I can't really speak to it, but it's a little creepy. And then obviously, like, Tinder was a big one. But I actually met my significant other by complete accident. I was driving through Charlotte, and a friend of mine was getting married, and she'd been with her partner for 10 years. And I, like, pulled it out, pulled out Tinder to show her what it was. And when I got to Atlanta, there was a glitch, and it didn't update my location. And I matched with my now partner, who lives in Charlotte. and we actually met in San Francisco, of all places. So very, very outside the perimeter.
Wow. You know, since you mentioned that, I'd love to encourage listeners who have met a significant other on online dating apps or have another great story to share with us. Please do on Facebook or Twitter at OST Talk. Now, Matthew, we all know that dating can also have some very serious issues. I brought up safety earlier, but you have talked about your role in HIV awareness. And something that is coming is new, I think, in many people's consciousness is dating across HIV lines.
Yes, it's called serodiscordance. Serostatus is your HIV status. And what researchers have proven in the past about a year is that if someone who is HIV positive is on treatment and undetectable, they are almost completely unlikely to pass the virus on to somebody. And then if the other partner who is HIV negative takes Truvada, which is an HIV prevention medicine, there's virtually no possibility of transmitting the virus between these partners. This is something that I think gay men can have inherently known for a while, but it's only been recently published. And I will say some of the strongest relationships between gay men that I have seen are between serodiscordant couples. And it's really wonderful that men and also straight people can date across HIV lines now.
That's extraordinary. I mean, that takes a lot of maturity.
Yes, absolutely.
haven't been in that situation, but I can only imagine that obviously it's worth it, right? Have you ever had that kind of conversation with somebody that you've been dating?
I've certainly been on dates with people who are HIV positive. I've never maintained a long-term relationship, but I would be completely open to it. I think about one of my role models, Charlie Atlas, the artist, not the bodybuilder. he talked about how he'd been with his partner since like the early 90s, even before these medicines existed. And There was a love and support there that I just thought was so beautiful for one person. Charlie was the HIV negative person. His partner was HIV positive. I think it can actually make a stronger relationship.
I have been speaking with podcaster Victoria Elizabeth, blogger Brittany Manson, and Atlanta-based artist Matthew Terrell. You are listening to On Second Thought. Just ahead, we will wish happy birthday to a giant of Macon music. But first, we will throw caution and political correctness to the wind with Rick and Morty. Stay tuned. It's On Second Thought. I'm Ricky Bevington, in for Celeste Headlee. We'll talk tomorrow about how anti-smoking campaigns may send the wrong message to smokers. Have you quit smoking? What worked? What didn't? You can call us at 404-500-9457 to tell us your story. And be sure to join us for that discussion tomorrow at 9 a.m. There is only one duo who can adventure through time and space and still debate about political correctness. This is Rick Sanchez and Morty Smith.
Cute. Your sister's boss gave me a microscope that would have made me retarded.
Ooh. Oh, boy, Rick. I don't think you're allowed to say that word.
That is Rick Sanchez and Morty Smith from Adult Swim's animated hit Rick and Morty. Rick is a genius scientist. His grandson, Morty, well, he's in high school. Together, they use portal guns and other wacky inventions to save the multiverse from hyper-intelligent dogs and cannibal mantis people. The show creator Dan Harmon sat down with my colleague Celeste Headlee a while back to discuss the program. Oh, and good news for fans in Savannah, the Rickmobile, a vehicle which is shaped like Rick, will be making a stop on Thursday at Bowtie Barbecue.
Hi.
So, I mean, you come to Rick and Morty after a pretty successful, long career in television, not just Community, but a bunch of other projects, which I won't list all off. But what did this pitch go like? I mean, how did you pitch Rick and Morty?
Well, Mike Lazo and Nick Weidenfeld, who was then working at Adult Swim as Lazo's kind of hand of the king, they both just were big enough Dan Harmon fans, based on Community mostly, to say at a certain point around season three of Community, you know, anything that you want to do on Adult Swim, just let us know. Like, you should be doing a show on Adult Swim. And I knew only by myself, that's not my crowd, because I'm not you know, juvenile or punk rock or anything, but because I'm just very kind of sterile in my sensibilities. Like, I really like to pair myself with genius, crazy people like Rob Schraub, who was my partner for a long time. We did the Sarah Silverman show together and wrote a bunch of feature scripts. And Justin is very much like Rob in that he's a very visual thinker. He's very he's compulsively lateral in his thought. Whereas I might be diagnosable with certain disorders that keep you kind of in a rut or hyper focused. Justin is very much in the ADHD category. And that's very valuable, because my worst enemy is myself. And so I went to Justin and said, you're the guy that should have an Adult Swim show, not me, but they're telling me I can have anyone that I want. So what do you want to do? And Justin said, well, to be honest, as silly as it seems, I'm really addicted to doing these voices of Rick and Morty.
This is a chemical release in a mammal's brain, you know, that makes it fall in love. All right, Morty, I just gotta combine it with some of your DNA.
Oh, well, okay.
A hair, Morty. I need one of your hairs. This isn't Game of Thrones.
Ow!
And I said, well, that's fine. There's no such thing as a bad idea in TV. You just take, you follow the bliss and the passion, and then you build something outward from there.
Wait, let's go back to that statement of there's no such thing as a bad idea in TV, because I feel like I've watched many.
Yeah, but you've watched them because they've all gotten greenlit, and they've crossed your path because they've been successful in some cases. It would be too snarky of me to name names, but the important thing to understand about TV is that it's by nature a derivative medium. You know, you don't turn it on in order to be immersed in the question, what is television? I mean, to a certain degree, you are going to it for comfort. You want a little bit of what you got yesterday. And yes, you definitely need to have a little bit of something you've never had before, or you'd send it back to the kitchen. But but fundamentally, it's you're going to television for a feeling, not not cleverness. You're supplanting, for better or for worse, your own chaotic family relationships with characters that are much like your best friends, very consistent in their patterns, and therefore able to be loved without fear of losing them to randomness.
I'm not sure you want to take romantic advice from this guy, Morty. His marriage is hanging from a thread.
My marriage is fine, thank you.
Jerry, it's your house. Whatever you say it is how it is, but I think a blind man could see that Beth is looking for the door. I barely have a reason to care, and even I notice.
Come on, Rick, don't talk about my parents like that.
Listen, Morty, I hate to break it to you, but what people call love is just a chemical reaction that compels animals to breed. It hits hard, Morty, then it slowly fades, leaving you stranded in a failing marriage. I did it. Your parents are gonna do it. Break the cycle, Morty. Rise above. Focus on science.
So let's hear another clip. And this, I mean, they're all kind of have become cult classics in their own way. But Mr. Meeseeks is supposed to help the family whenever they need something done. And then was supposed to disappear when the task is over. And in this particular case, Jerry, which is Rick's son-in-law, asks Mr. Meeseeks to take two strokes off of his golf swing.
That's okay. I'm Mr. Meeseeks. Look at me. Try again and keep your head down.
Okay, well, which is it? Square my shoulders or keep my head down?
Well, it's both. Let me try something. I'm Mr. Meeseeks. Look at me.
Hi, Mr. Meeseeks. I'm Mr. Meeseeks. Look at me.
Hi.
Can you help me get two strokes off of Jerry's golf swing?
Can do. I'm Mr. Meeseeks.
Is he keeping his shoulders squared?
Ooh, he's trying.
but, I mean, when you're creating these characters who end up becoming iconic, we're going to talk more about your story circle, but what is it about, do you have a formula for creating a character that will become memorable and that people will invest in?
I would say no, if there's been any consistent template to the characters that stick out for people, it's definitely centered on Justin and whatever it is that's right and wrong with his brain. Mr. Meeseeks is a great example. I can't remember how we began talking about that story. I do distinctly remember a point. Or maybe now I've mythologized it, but you know how memory works. I've listened to NPR shows where they talk about how memory is a lie, but I think Radiolab talked about that. But I in my memory, Justin was at one point so frustrated with the story breaking process that he was rolling around on the floor of the writer's room saying like.
Wait, literally rolling around on the floor?
That's how I remember it. But, you know, I don't know if Justin would want to be characterized that way. But for me, it's the reason I remember it is for a very positive reason, which is that he started literally saying, like, I'm Mr. Meeseeks. Look at me. Like just he was kind of just throwing a joyful fit. Like, well, let's just do that. That's the thing that comes out of the box. And that's how we'll approach this. And Justin, you should do the voice of the characters and just do it exactly like that. And there's a million examples of that, which are, you know, we start out with the traditional method of trying to break sitcom stories. So we would try to abide by that and structure, but like it's when Justin actually starts to just get bored that I find if we can avoid getting frustrated by his boredom and not condemn him for it and rather just say, oh, well, the boss is bored, man. So let's move on, or let's just like use the crazy thing that's coming out of his mouth. And those have been really our biggest triumphs.
Where are my testicles, Summer? They were removed. Where have they gone?
Oh, wow. That's an intense line of questioning, Snuffles.
Do not call me that. Snuffles was my slave name. You shall now call me Snowball, because my fur is pretty and white.
Okay, Snowball, just calm down, okay? You're scaring me.
Scaring you? Tell me, Summer, if a human was born with stumpy legs, would they breed it with another deformed human and put their children on display like the dachshund?
Now, the Justin that Dan Harmon keeps referring to is Justin Roiland. He's not only does the voices of both Rick and Morty, but you also heard his voice on Adventure Time and Fish Hooks and a bunch of other things. He has many, many voices. I'm speaking with Rick and Morty co-creator Dan Harmon. Now, you are famous for this this thing that you invented. Since we're speaking about sort of the templates of character creation and story, you're famous for this story circle that you created, and I understand it was based on a Joseph Campbell idea, and right. it's a circle with eight segments, taking a character from comfort through a trial and an adventure back to comfort, and then it can start all over again. And you have said, you're quoted as saying that you can't not see that circle; it's tattooed on your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at this point, so you use it even unconsciously.
This is just wild speculation, but I think that the primate branch of evolution represents the cutting edge of experimentation in evolutionary strategy, adaptability over, for instance, becoming incredibly key and tumbler geared to your environment. So I think for that reason, that's just total speculation. We have this sort of shape of information that we digest a lot more easily than say, for instance, the shape of information in a phone book. When if I tell you you should vote for this candidate instead of that candidate, it's gonna bounce off your hull as just sort of like getting lectured. But if I tell you that I used to vote like you used to vote, and then I went and did this one random thing because this crazy thing happened, and then this other crazy thing started to happen, and then I realized this thing, I start reeling you in. And the worst people in world history have learned this, and that's called propaganda. When you use story structure to poison people with bad ideas, but it's also because that's the shape of ideas that we digest.
So, how good are you at predicting which of your projects will be successful and not? Did you expect, for example, that Rick and Morty would become so successful?
I did not expect it to become not this level. I expected it would have a small but passionate audience that would be more than enough to make me happy. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me that it's so popular.
Really? You don't understand it?
I mean, when you put it that way, I guess I can understand it, but I didn't predict it. You know, I can understand the recent election, but I didn't predict it. I can understand lots of things that shock me. But it's there's a lot of, you know, there's parents that watch the show with their kids. And that was just, I thought there were higher walls demographically than there turned out to be.
So what would you think? I mean, what ends up happening a lot of times when a show is this successful is that networks try to spin off, right? They want to make as much as possible off that one idea. Would you be open to Rick and Morty related shows or other platforms?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. If Law and Order can do it, I mean, I think that Rick and Morty is particularly conducive to all kinds of wild spin-off experiments because of it. It's fundamental to the Rick and Morty verse that there's infinite universes.
I just upgraded our cable package with programming from every conceivable reality.
Wait, does that mean we get Showtime Extreme?
How about Showtime Extreme in a world where man evolved from corn?
We're not so different. We're both corn of action.
Yeah, but one of us is dead corn!
boring.
Summer, you just spent 3 months watching a man choose a fake wife.
So what? It'd be better if the people were corn?
Jerry, you don't get it. This is infinite TV from infinite universes.
And infinite versions of yourself and infinite versions of everyone and infinite versions of all histories. So it's built right in there that if you wanted to, you could immediately launch a show called Morty and Rick, where, you know, they had different colored shirts and the writing style was decidedly different. The way that when you watch Criminal Intent, it's like more like Sherlock Holmes than the original Law and Order. That would be really exciting to me.
That is Dan Harmon, co-creator of Adult Swim's Rick and Morty. If you're a fan in Savannah, be sure to check out the Rickmobile at Bowtie Barbecue this Thursday. One of Georgia's most iconic musicians was born this day in 1932. Macon's Richard Wayne Pennyman was one in a family of 12 children. He grew up singing gospel in the Pentecostal church. His big break came in September 1955 when he recorded the song called Tutti Frutti. His style influenced countless musicians, including Kate Pearson of the B-52s. She recently nominated Tutti Frutti for our compilation of Essential Music by Georgia Artists, the Georgia Playlist.
It's the same kind of thing as James Brown in a way. You can't stop dancing, and he's also sort of the king of rock and roll, or the one of the fathers of rock and roll. It's one of those songs that you could say, okay, the lyrics really are genius in their simplicity.
She rocked to the east, she rocked to the west, but she's the gal that I love best.
You know, do people just say, like, oh, what do these crazy lyrics mean? No, sometimes they'll take B-52 songs out of context and, you know, they'll read the lyrics and say, this is just so, like, how can this be a song? But, you know, this is an example of these lyrics, which apparently he got from some teenage girl, I think. He heard, overheard, or she said Tutti Frutti. But, you know, you get your inspiration from wherever. But, I mean, that is just so genius the way he put that together. And it's just, in some ways, nonsense, but in some ways it's the most profound thing you could ever sing. Tutti Frutti. Oh, Rudy. Tutti Frutti. Nobody could sing like a little Richard. He's one of a kind. Also, like growing up, you know, gay and Macon, I mean, he's got to be like made of some tough stuff. And I think he's just, you know, just such a brave person to grow up, you know, and do the music he did. And I just think he blazed a trail. I don't think there's one particular sound for the state. No, there's just, Athens is a unique sound. I think Macon had its sound, certainly. And there's a, I think, the really big rap scene in Atlanta. So there's an Atlanta sound, I think, too. And there's a lot of creativity in Georgia.
That was Kate Pearson of the B-52s. We talked to her last year about her favorite songs by Georgia artists. Happy 85th birthday, Little Richard. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. What is your favorite song from the Peach State? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. Feel free to sing a little. You can also post to Facebook or reach us on Twitter at OSTTalk. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Ricky Bevington, in for Celeste Headley. Have a great day.